the Indie Week. This issue of podcast is dated February the 16th of 2023. The North Carolina Reading Service presents the program. This podcast is for our blind and print impaired listeners. And the current issue is read today by John Federson. All right, we'll start with the online IndieWeek.com, which has several articles which are of a later print date than the print edition, which came out yesterday. North Carolina Republicans advance bills loosening NC gun laws. Hours after three students at Michigan State were killed by a man who ultimately turned his gun on himself, North Carolina Republicans unveiled several bills Tuesday aimed at making it easier for people to acquire and wield firearms. Senator Danny Britt, Republican Robeson of Scotland, said during a press conference, "These are common sense gun legislation bills." Senate Judiciary Committee considered three bills Tuesday, Senate Bills 40, 41, and 67. Those proposals would repeal the pistol purchase permit required to obtain a firearm in North Carolina. It would allow people with a concealed carry license to bring their weapon into a house of worship that has a school on its property and launch a voluntary two-year statewide firearm safe storage awareness initiative. Senators combined those bills into one piece of legislation before advancing it out of committee. The House and Senate have passed the versions of the pistol purchase permit repeal and the Protect Religious Meeting Places bills in prior legislative sessions. Governor Cooper vetoed those measures when they reached his desk, but thanks to gains in the midterm elections, Republicans could have the votes to override a new veto. Republicans challenged their Democratic colleagues to vote with them on the proposals, arguing that some of them campaigned on common sense gun reform. Asked why it was common sense to ease access to firearms by eliminating a regulatory hurdle, Britt replied that the bills would still bar people with criminal records from obtaining guns because those individuals would still be barred from legally acquiring a firearm thanks to a federal background check they have to clear before acquiring the weapon. He said, "What we're doing is making it easy for legal, law-abiding citizens to go out and purchase a firearm to protect themselves." They framed the pistol permit repeal as a racial justice measure, stating the law was passed in the Jim Crow era to restrict black people from acquiring handguns. They claimed that the spirit of that discrimination lives on, citing a Wake County statistic that three times as many people of color were denied purchase permits than other segments of the population. Britt said, "I see you're laughing, but it's a very serious deal coming from one of the most racially diverse counties in the state. It's very important to me that those folks are not discriminated against." Now, Senator Warren Daniel, Republican of Buncombe, said the Religious Meeting Places bill would close a loophole that should not exist. Most churches in North Carolina are allowed to decide whether firearms are allowed in their grounds, except for those who have a school on their property. "To be clear," said Daniel, "this bill will not allow for firearms to be brought into those spaces during school hours or on any public school property." Pastor of a church in Winston-Salem, Reverend Ron Beatty, said the proposal would make churches safer. Quote, "Shooters choose gun-free zones because they're easy targets where they can do maximum damage in the least amount of time. Cowards go where there are no deterrents." The third proposal would allow state agencies to launch a voluntary two-year firearm safe storage awareness program that would disseminate information on the safe storage of guns, share links to web pages on domestic violence, hunter education, and suicide prevention, and provide contact information so people can acquire free gun locks. Senator Bobby Hoenig, a Republican representing 10 eastern counties, said, "We want the public to know what options there are for safe storage of firearms. It's that simple." Senator Jim Perry, Republican Beaufort of Craven and Lenore, said, anticipating criticism, there tend to be a lot of amateur sheriffs running around when bills of this sort are introduced. Going on, if this was something that was going to put everyone in some type of great harm, I think this room would be filled right now with sheriffs from every county, and that's just not the case. Shortly afterward, a House Judiciary Committee advanced its own version of the pistol permit repeal and the Protect Churches proposal. Marcus Bass, Deputy Director of the North Carolina Black Alliance, opposed the permit repeal because he said the permit prevent homicides and suicides. He said Black and Latinx North Carolinians bore a disproportionate brunt of homicide deaths across the state, saying, "This violence is a result of societal and systemic factors, which are compounded by firearms that are often trafficked in the most impacted neighborhoods. In this case, we believe the state's current pistol permit helps to prevent diversion of illegal firearms in the communities most suffering from gun violence." Jeff McNeely, Republican of Iredale, said the goal of the Protect Religious Meeting Places was simple. We're just enforcing your constitutional rights. Several members of the public volunteered their thoughts on the bill. The Reverend Jennifer Copeland, North Carolina Council of Churches, opposed it. "We want to talk about people who put their hand in the till of the gun lobby fund and then cause harm to the vulnerable people of North Carolina. I come from a tradition where God has some strong words to say about those who take money in the effort to create harm." Several of the members of the public who testified invoked past slaughters that were carried out with guns. Mitchell Pinsky, a volunteer with North Carolina Students Demand Action, recalled the massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida, 10 minutes from where his parents live, saying, "Students huddled in their classrooms, the bullets ricocheted in the hallways, only to pass over the bloody dead bodies of their peers. Unfortunately, this is what happens when we pass reckless gun laws. If we pass these bills, there will only be more gun violence." Paul Vallone, the president of Grassroots North Carolina, which lobbies for looser laws, spoke after Pinsky. He, too, recalled a recent mass shooting, the one in Michigan, a day prior, saying, "What we saw yesterday was yet another example of a gun-free zone attracting a violent sociopath. We've seen it over and over again. Our goal is to shut down those gun-free zones and make sure people can protect themselves." Now, the next story, originally published online at NC Policy Watch, Heritage Collegiate Leadership Academy of Wake County's application to open in 2024 was unanimously rejected by the State Board of Education, despite a glowing recommendation from the Charter School Advisory Board. That charter board had rejected an earlier version of the application, but cited a new, stronger application and an impressive assemblage of people to serve on the school's board of directors for its change of heart. The Board of Education didn't explain its reason for denying the application, but Amy White, who chairs the board's Education, Innovation, and Charter School Committee, signaled last month she would not support it over concerns about the founding director, Kashi Bazemore's, leadership at a charter school, also known as Heritage Collegiate Leadership Academy, in Bertie County. It's unusual for the two boards to take such starkly differing stances about an application. Generally, the state board follows CSAB's recommendations. This time was different. White said during the state board's January meeting, "I would have a much more confidence given the fact there's a strong board and a strong application, but that particularly past practice is tainting my review. I need to get that on the table because there were many students in Bertie County School that suffered as a result of very significant poor mismanagement." Less than a week after the state board's January vote, Bazemore went before the charter board to share concerns about White. White was a member of the Wake County Board of Education when Bazemore worked for the school district as an assistant principal and had, quote, a legal situation that resulted in Bazemore filing a sexual harassment claim against her boss, Bazemore shared. She, White, would have been a part of that, Bazemore said, and I want to place that on the record with the hope this is not a conflict of interest, but a certainty with the hope that we will look into it. Bazemore also said White has been supportive of Wake Preparatory Academy, a K-12 charter school just across the Wake County line in Franklin County. Bazemore School would compete for students against Wake Prep, she said. Since Franklin County is under a court-ordered desegregation plan, Wake Prep must try to enroll a student population that reflects county demographics. And Bazemore continued, I know that Wake Prep need minority students coming from northern Wake County in order to meet the requirements of the de facto segregation order that's in place in Franklin County. I genuinely hope that has not played a role here. White did not respond to an email seeking comment about Bazemore's claims and further explanation about the board's decision to not approve the application. However, Charter Board Vice Chairman Bruce Friend said his board also had concerns about Bazemore's leadership in Bertie County. After going through the application process and conducting interviews, the board felt, quote, confident this Heritage Collegiate Board, if given the opportunity to have this charter school, will succeed. And Friend told the State Board, what we found in this particular application was a really solid education plan we feel will work, particularly for the location and the students they intend to serve. The Charter Board Chairwoman, Cheryl Turner, said she believes Bazemore gets it and will not make the same mistakes that were made in Bertie County. Turner recalled Bazemore had trouble getting the required documents completed and turned in on time. She also noted that the school had a weak board of directors that she described as, quote, almost non-existent, saying, this is not what we saw this time. This was a very strong board. There were issues with following through and getting things turned in. I think those are the lessons that were most learned. I think the school leader, Bazemore, now gets it that this stuff cannot be ignored. You can't get to it later. The Bertie County version of the school opened in 2014. Control was assumed in 2018 by Raleigh businessman Don McQueen after state education officials found serious academic, governance, and operational issues under Bazemore's leadership. McQueen renamed the school Three Rivers Academy. The transfer was arranged to prevent the school from closing. But the proposed cure for what ailed the school proved to be worse than the illness, and the state board ordered the school to close last year after a lengthy investigation by Department of Public Instruction found many of the same serious financial and governance issues. Now, McQueen's flagship school in Raleigh, Torchlight Academy, was also ordered closed by the state board because many of the same financial and government shortcomings found at Three Rivers. After the school's close, state education leaders vowed to be more vigilant in their oversight of the state's more than 200 charter schools. Bazemore's new application calls for a K-8 school that would eventually grow to 600 students in 5 years. Bazemore has said the school would primarily serve Black and Latinx students in northeastern and eastern Wake County, whom she contends are not adequately served by the Wake County public school system. Supplemental data provided by the Heritage Planning Teams last month show many of the elementary and middle schools in northeast Wake have received state performance grade letters of D or F. Bazemore told the CSAB 4 days after the state board's vote, we are simply looking for an opportunity to show what's possible for students who are failing to make growth at Wake County Public Schools currently. We're talking about Black, poor, brown, and exceptional children, and we want to be clear we're not excluding anyone. Under state law, Heritage Collegiate Academy still has a chance to be approved. The state board sent the application back to the Charter School Advisory Board, and the state board will take up the application again in March for a final vote. All right, let's move over to the print edition of Indie Week. Get engaged, writes Jasmine Gallup. CACs are coming back. 3 years, just about to the day, after abruptly dismantling citizen advisory councils, Raleigh's leaders are once again giving them an opportunity to join in the conversation around important issues, including the city's extreme growth. A new community engagement plan, first presented to the City Council during its retreat in late January, includes a recommendation to temporarily allow citizen advisory councils free use of 5 of the city's 27 community centers, one in each district. After approval from the City Council during a meeting last week, CACs are now allowed to use the city's community centers until a more formal community engagement network is established. The network is expected to include CACs and other community-based groups, all of which would have free access to city community centers and other resources. The change does not restore CACs to the status they once had, where they could make formal recommendations to the council, but it does give them a place to meet, which could help revitalize the now scattered network of neighborhood groups. In the three-year interim since CACs were disbanded, many of the smaller organizations have fallen apart. Christina Jones, council member, wrote in an email to Indie Week, "We had 18 CACs prior to being dismantled, and I think roughly half of that may take part." Jones, by the way, is also the chair of overseeing Raleigh CAC. She wrote, "I hope all CACs will take advantage of the free meeting space provided by the city as the first step toward this new program. This is their opportunity to connect with other community groups and help grow engagement throughout the city. There are strong leaders both inside and outside of the CAC structure, and when they combine forces, they will be unstoppable." During last week's City Council meeting, Jones expressed some concerns over the number of CACs that are currently inactive. Raleigh's community engagement manager, Tisha Hinton, said the city plans to reach out to those inactive groups, starting with the previous chairpersons. They also plan to support now defunct CACs in becoming active again, if that's their goal, said Hinton. The city's immediate plan for engagement is not perfect. Jones noted that CACs don't cover the entire city, so some areas may be left out. Other council members also expressed concern over giving community centers access to CACs, while other groups are temporarily excluded, though there is an existing discount for nonprofits. Ultimately, giving CACs free access to community centers and the tables, chairs, internet access, and projectors that come with them is just one step in a wider community engagement plan, said Hinton. The plan includes immediate actions as well as short and long-term goals for community engagement. Mayor Pro Tem Corey Branch said during last week's meeting, "It's 3 years to the day since CACs changed. At that time, I voted not to get rid of CACs or move them because we didn't have a plan. It's taken us too long. This is a step in that direction." During last week's City Council meeting, the council also unanimously approved a measure to hold town hall meetings 4 times a year, rather than only twice a year. City staff also plan to kick off an engagement campaign that increases offline communication between the city and Raleigh residents, said Hinton. "That's touching libraries, Department of Social Services, and it's really enhancing the way we engage off the internet." City Council members have talked in the past about improving offline communication, including posting paper announcements on doors that notify people of major projects. For example, during the Dix Edge area study, one way the city conducted outreach was by going door to door. The city has also started improving its website with online pages about opportunities for residents to give their 2 cents to city staff. both in person and online. Another item on the agenda is public comment. For the last couple of years, public comment has been one of the few ways for people to speak directly to City Council members. After returning to in-person meetings, the City Council added an option to leave comments via voicemail, although many continue to criticize a 3-minute time limit for all public comments. Now, the City Council is considering holding additional meetings reserved only for public comment, a measure that could bring some relief from hours-long evening meetings where comments can take more than an hour. The city is also looking at adding a time minimum and more widely spreading information about how and when people can comment. Last Tuesday, Hinton also gave a presentation on the city's various boards and commissions, another way the city engages people, particularly how people can view and participate in them. Explaining, of the city's 21 boards and commissions, 11 meet in person only with no option for online viewing or attendance. That includes, ironically, the Community Engagement Board, as well as Police Advisory, Environmental Advisory, and several boards dealing with the arts and other issues. The remaining 10 boards and commissions, like Planning Commission, Raleigh Transit, Historic Development, and others, all have meetings that can be viewed online, although access varies. The City Council prioritizing the development of this community engagement network mentioned above, which is expected to take 6 to 12 months. The network will likely include small nonprofits, student groups, churches, civic organizations, social groups, and topic-focused groups that want to participate in government decision-making. These community groups wouldn't have free access just to meeting spaces, but also to other resources, said Hinton. That could include a community relations analyst assigned to each group, access to city equipment, and the ability to send out mailings twice a year. The city also plans to give these groups access to strategic planning tools and help them set goals that are SMART, specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. SMART. Unfortunately, not every nonprofit will have access to all these resources, since there are hundreds across the city, noted City Manager Marshall Adams David. Provided access to CACs is a first step toward restoring the privileges they once had, but going forward, the city will now have to have intentional conversations about how to spread the love, she said. And going on, she said, not every nonprofit, even if they have the appropriate credentials, is going to be able to use the space because we have so many programs that make parks, recreation, and cultural resources what it is. We're going to have to figure out the parameters of when, how often, and which groups are going to be afforded the opportunity to use the space because those rental revenues help offset the expenses of the department. Within the next year, the city also hopes to start hosting regular meet-and-greets between residents and city departments that offer services like Raleigh Water, Solid Waste, and Transportation. During those events, staff would be able to educate residents on city services. Now, Hinton outlined during that City Council retreat two long-term goals. First, established an external community engagement service unit in which residents would work with city staff to address the needs of the community. For example, the unit could help add sidewalks and bus stops to areas that need them, bolster sustainability and stormwater management efforts, or help add public art and historic markers. Second, Hinton talked about the creation of a City of Raleigh Expo, a biannual event in which city staff would answer questions, share engagement opportunities, and pass out educational materials at various booths organized by a department. Both goals are expected to take 1 to 3 years to fully implement. These short and long-term goals can only be accomplished with additional funding from the city, which council members are considering as they discuss the budget for fiscal year 23-24. The Community Engagement Department is asking for enough funding to hire several more full-time employees, as well as fund these long-term projects. Now, budget discussions will last several months before a final budget is approved sometime this June. This year's budget work sessions are set for February 20, March 13, and April 10. An online survey on budget priorities is open to the community through February 28, and a public hearing on the proposed budget is set for June 6. And that concludes the article. There is a little sidebar which includes the elements that I've already read to you, but I'll go over them again. The Community Engagement Plan, immediate, from 0 to 6 months, gives CAC free access to community center. That's been approved by the council. Host quarterly town hall meetings. That's been approved. Start an offline engagement campaign. Staff are working on it. That's immediate. The short term, 6 to 12 months. Develop a community engagement network. That's pending funding. And host regular meet and greets with city service department. And long term, 1 and 3 years, create an external community engagement service unit and host a City of Raleigh Expo. Now, a very recent development that Tomasi McDonald writes about from Durham that's very exciting to me, at least, and assume anybody else who has maybe a musical interest or an interest in jazz or any such. A bittersweet victory is the title of this article. Last month, a team of judges led by jazz giant Wynton Marsalis selected North Carolina Central University's Jazz Studies program as the top college jazz band in the country. I'll read that again. NC Central, top college jazz band in the country. But it was a bittersweet honor coming months after the orchestra's director, Brian Horton, was found dead in his Durham home in September. During and after their award-winning performance at the 2023 Jazz Championship at New York's Lincoln Center, the spirit of the student's former director, professor, and mentor was omnipresent. Last year, Horton had led that big band to a third-place finish at the championship. Lenora Helm-Hammonds, the interim chair of NC Central's music department and director of the school's graduate program for jazz studies, said, "After Dr. Horton passed away, we really, really needed this moment." Horton himself was a tenor saxophonist and composer who had also led a trio of musicians, horn, upright bass, and drums at the Kingfisher Bar on West Chapel Hill Street in Durham. He was 46 when he died, just 6 days shy of his birthday. His sudden death rocked the Triangle's jazz community, and it devastated the students and the faculty with the Jazz Studies program. Big band member Dexter Moses, who grabbed an honorable mention for his solo work on alto sax during that competition, says, quote, "Dr. Horton, he showed us no matter where you began, he came from Kinston, you could play high-quality music. He could have taught anywhere, but he came back here, and it was kind of humbling to witness that. He was integrating the real world with education," went on Moses, "and would also encourage his students to study other music forms, classical, rhythm and blues, and use it to their advantage. He made people feel creatively valued." Now, orchestra member Shakeem Moldrow said Horton's sudden death changed everything. The big band members and faculty dedicated their January performance to their fallen leader. Moldrow says, "If a section forgot a part, somebody would say, hey, we're not doing this for play. We're doing this for Horton." A month before Horton died, during the second week of August, Muldrow says the professor was considering tunes for this Jack Rudin competition. He remembers how diligent Horton was in his preparation for class. You could tell he was dedicated and passionate about it. Now, folks, North Carolina, in comparison to other schools that boast world-class resources, was the only historically black college in the competition. It appeared outgunned and outmatched, at least in theory. Robert Towers, an NCCU jazz professor who directed that winning performance, told Indy there are fewer than 10 jazz studies programs at these roughly historically black colleges and universities. Quote, it's really important in that it gives a message to HBCUs in this area. HBCUs have the potential to be with the best. In a lot of circles, it's thought that HBCUs aren't into jazz. They're more into marching and concert bands. So Muldrow compares the Jack Rudin victory to that of a 1935 debate team of Wiley College, a tiny private HBCU in Marshall, Texas, that defeated the reigning national debate team champion, University of Southern California. Quote, we're a small school competing against bigger schools with more resources through grants and funding. Sometimes, Brian Horton used to say, we always have to do the most with the least. Horton suggested Muldrow try a different approach when soloing on Chinoiserie. That's the first movement in Duke Ellington's suite, the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse. Quote, he told me to hit a high note and hold it. I told him, I don't know, Dr. Horton. He told me the piece had a lot of high notes, and there's a lot you could play. He said, just pick one you're really feeling. Muldrow's solo on Chinoiserie played no small part in the judge's decision to award first place. The orchestra played that tune in the first and second rounds of the competition, and the audience roared their approval each time after Muldrow's solos. Quote, with all that's happened this past year, it just made it special. Now, that jazz championship just took place on January 14 and 15, attracts the top collegiate jazz programs in the country. NCCU was one of nine schools in attendance, along with Michigan State, Temple University, Florida State, Ithaca College from New York, the University of Wyoming, the Peabody Institute of the Johns Hopkins University, Vanderbilt, and Northern Illinois University. And folks, these are huge music and jazz schools. Huge. Michigan State defending champion placed third, and Temple, based in Philadelphia, placed second. Travers said his hopes dimmed a bit when he heard those announcements. The other bands were so good, he says. And I started thinking, maybe next year. Then I heard North Carolina, and the students were making so much noise. He says there was a lot of excitement and even more tears of joy. He was sitting near the rear of the hall. He said, I had to run, but not too fast. I wanted to be relaxed. I knew it was being recorded. And I didn't want to be recorded running frantically on camera. Helm Hemmons, interim chair, praises Temple and Michigan State's performances, said they are both great bands. HBCUs are elbow to elbow compared to the other schools, and Trowers agrees. This is a statement that we have the potential to be as good as anyone else. The school also received honorable mention for its trumpet and saxophone sections. Now, although the College Jazz Championship is only in its third year, it is a significant event. Marsalis, the jazz musician, is Lincoln Center's managing and artistic director. According to his website, Jazz at Lincoln Center is the largest jazz education program network in the world. He states the educational objectives are grounded in Lincoln Center's 35-year history in jazz performance and appreciation. Jazz students are also guided on how to better communicate personal objectives within the art form, and they become more aware of the mission of jazz musicians today by building on the aspirations laid by earlier generations. This Jack Rudin Championship honors the legacy of Jack Rudin, a native New Yorker who fought in World War II, receiving a Bronze Star. He went on to become a philanthropist and one of the most prolific builders of skyscrapers in Manhattan. He was a longtime supporter of jazz at Lincoln Center, and the Jazz Championship honors, quote, his founding support for essentially Ellington, the organization's signature transformative education program. And Rudin died in 2016 at age 92. I'll abridge some of the rest and skip. The past year was a tough one for NC Central's jazz studies. Months before Horton died, Arnold George, an assistant professor who had been with the program, died in June. According to the school's website, George had been with the program since 1991 and directed his vocal jazz ensemble, which had won multiple Downbeat magazine awards, had twice performed at the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland and Paris. But other factors enabled the jazz studies program to endure and continue to thrive, namely an unrelenting adherence to the jazz tradition, coupled with longtime faculty members who are also seasoned professional musicians and have spent ample time playing on the road. Let's see. So there are several more people spotlighted in this article about NC Central's recent best college jazz ensemble in the nation. And let's see. And I'll close that article for now. You can see it in a couple of photos and read the full article at indieweek.com if you so choose. Next article from the print by Joe Killian. 100 Steps Back, Transgender Youth Face an Uncertain Future as Legislation Targets Their Identities. In many ways, Alex Lounsbery has been lucky. He knows that. Now in his senior year at Atkins High, a technology magnate in Winston-Salem, he's happy, healthy, and looking toward the future, but it wasn't easy getting there. Assigned a female at birth, Alex knew he was transgender by the time he was in middle school, but he wasn't ready to talk about it with parents, teachers, and all of his friends right away. When he did come out to his family, they were supportive. He told Policy Watch this week, where this article was first printed, they just wanted to be healthy and happy. I know a lot of people don't have that from their parents. I wish everyone did. They wanted me to be myself and be who I really am. For Lounsbery and his family, that meant transitioning, first, socially, telling friends, family, teachers, and administrators he was changing name and gender pronouns. Nobody was ready for it, he said. The school had never encountered a transgender student. He said there was bullying, even assault, but my parents supported me. We sat down with teachers, the principal. It just took time and persistence. At 16, he and his family began talking with doctors about hormone replacement therapy to begin a physical transition. In a few months, he'll take the next step, a, quote, top surgery to remove his breasts, which he's been working towards slowly and deliberately for years. At every step, with the backing of family and the knowledge and advice of his doctors, he's felt more at home and at peace in his own body. As he moves toward graduation this year, he's happy the environment has changed for young trans people since he came out. Quote, it's just something people understand a little better now. They know about it more. Teachers hand out introductory cards at the beginning of the year asking about preferred names and pronouns. That's really helpful. There's more of an understanding. But under two new bills moving through the North Carolina General Assembly, that could all radically change. Senate Bill 49 would, among other provisions, require teachers to notify parents if a student questions their own gender, outing many young trans people before they're ready to tell their families, who might be hostile to their identities. House Bill 43 would make it illegal for anyone under 18 to receive this sort of gender-affirming care Lounsbury did. He can't help thinking about how much more difficult his life would have been under laws such as these. He said, "This would have been my nightmare. Being outed, not being able to speak my truth about who I really am in my own time when I decided to, and to not be able to make a decision with my family and doctors. I don't see why it's anybody else's place to say why they belong in that conversation." For Lounsbury and many transgender youth, the two bills offer a perplexing insight into what lawmakers believe to be the place of government in family and medical decisions. Under Senate 49, the so-called Parents' Bill of Rights, the place of parents is paramount in any discussion of gender, sexuality, and identity. Its sponsors argue the government in this case, though teachers and school administrators, through teachers and school administrators, has no place in conversations about a young person's gender identity without parents. But under House Bill 43, parents like Lounsbury's, who support their children and follow the standard of care prescribed by doctors and myriad medical associations, would see the government intervene to prevent any steps toward transition until they're 18. These contradictory ideas about family versus government seem to be bridged by one overarching belief, Lounsbury said. It's an assumption that being transgender is dangerous, something to protect children against, even if their families and doctors don't share that view. Quote, "What they're saying is the parents should have these conversations and make these decisions, unless they support you. Then the government just makes the decision it wants them to. It's only the parents who are against it whose rights matter." After years of advocacy, transgender North Carolinians have finally made progress, securing hard-won legal victories about their rights to gender-affirming health care coverage and the right to change their gender marker on government documents. But now, they're facing a backlash. More than 200 anti-LGBTQ bills have been filed across the country already this year. Republicans who picked up seats in state houses are pushing through legislation and will likely use it to campaign on it in the next election cycle. The certainty of a veto from Governor Roy Cooper, a Democrat, kept Republican leaders in the General Assembly even from bringing some LGBTQ bills to a vote in the last session. But with gains in the last election, Republicans again have the votes to override a veto in the state Senate and need the support or absence of just one Democrat in the House to override it in that chamber. That new legislative math makes bills codifying the most conservative view of gender identity a real possibility, despite the objections of LGBTQ families and the mainstream medical community. Lounsbury says it doesn't feel like a step back. It feels like a couple hundred. It's completely and utterly terrifying to know that just being myself is possibly going to become illegal in some ways. For State Representative Marsha Morey, Democrat of Durham, the attacks on LGBTQ people aren't new. One of the General Assembly's few outed LGBTQ legislators, she spent years promoting bills that would offer greater protections for those marginalized communities. Under a Republican majority, those bills can't even get a hearing. With the new bills aimed at a gender identity, Morey said GOP lawmakers are sending a very clear message. Quote, "The damage that we're doing by introducing these bills is communicates to certain young people that something is fundamentally wrong with them. They're watching. They're listening. They're paying attention as we're trying to legislate their identities at a very tender time." This week, another state representative, Vernetta Alston from Durham, another out legislator, sponsored a competing House bill she said will account for the rights of both parents and students, including families like hers. Alston and her wife are also parents, she said in a press conference. LGBTQ students and their families need to be acknowledged when lawmakers legislate gender identity and sexuality. Quote, Like so many parents, my number one priority in life is the health, safety, and well-being of my children. Instead, my Senate colleagues are debating bills like Senate 49, a bill that will harm our students, especially LGBTQ students, who will only be more vulnerable and more isolated at school if 49 passes. Department of Health and Human Services report shows a 46% increase in North Carolina youth reporting a depressive episode since the COVID pandemic began nearly 3 years ago. One in five high school students seriously contemplated suicide last year, according to their report. For some LGBTQ students, that number is one in two. Medical experts point to years of studies that show that legislation targeting LGBTQ youth, particularly in schools where many find support they lack at home, contributes to a rise in depression and suicidal ideation. On Wednesday, a panel of doctors from Duke University who study the issue and treat LGBTQ people spoke out against the bills now moving through the legislature. Dr. Sarah Willerson, assistant professor at the Duke Sexual and Gender Minority Health Program, quote, "There is a high likelihood both these bills would have reverberating impacts on the health of LGBTQ children throughout North Carolina." That's clear when studying the aftermath of House Bill 2, Wilson said. That 2016 law excluded lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people from statewide non-discrimination protections. That legislation caused a national firestorm with protests and boycotts leading to a partial repeal. For LGBTQ people who lived through the having their identities and rights debated and assailed daily throughout that controversy, the effects were devastating. Wilson pointed to a two-year study in HB2's wake, highlighting a number of alarming trends. She said, "In North Carolina, after HB2, we saw gender identity-motivated hate crimes actually increased in the state. So, there can be these larger cultural effects of the legislation that can adversely affect these individuals by normalizing stigma. Where there's stigma, oftentimes there is increased violence." During HB2 controversy and its aftermath, state lawmakers promoted right-wing groups that opposed same-sex marriage while rejecting the medical mainstream conclusion of the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, and American Academy of Pediatrics. Wilson says that came at a cost. Quote, "There are downstream effects of that increased exposure to stigma, violence, and hate crimes where North Carolinians who are LGBTQ reported feeling increased depression and anxiety. This is a group that already faces disproportionate rates of discrimination, harassment, stigma, and these bills serve to potentially have an amplifying effect for these inequities we already see." Transgender people, especially youth and people of color, suffered the greatest negative impact. Wilson said suicidal ideation increased among transgender and gender nonconforming North Carolinians and hate crimes increased. Depression and anxiety amongst transgender North Carolinians also increased. "We saw these reverberating effects throughout people's lives. We saw people delaying health care because of these bills, because there was a concern over general attitude towards transgender and non-binary folks. Limiting what students can hear, read, and say about gender identity in their schools is particularly dangerous," Wilson said, "as LGBTQ youth often find badly needed support and community there." Quote, "We know the majority of LGBTQ youth report their home is not LGBTQ-affirming, 3 out of 5. The rates are actually a little higher for schools. There are more LGBTQ who report their school is an affirming place than report their home is. Youth and adults turn to friends, teachers, other people in the community to be able to gain that acceptance and willingness to support the person regardless of their sexual orientation," or general gender identity. Sponsors of the bill see that as the problems. Senator Amy Gailey, an Alamance County Republican, one of the main sponsors of SB 49, says parents do not surrender their children to government schools for indoctrination opposed to the family's values. That view was amplified in a Senate Rules Committee meeting where members of the conservative group Moms for Liberty made clear the religious motivations of the bill's support. Quote, Nathan Jarosinski, a board member of Moms for Liberty of Iredell County, quote, "It seems that it would be extreme emotional abuse by the system to allow a child to believe and grow into something that is against the definition given by the Bible of truth and God's word as far as their sexuality. To allow the state to define that is even further of an abomination." The view that acceptance and support for LGBTQ students amounts to indoctrination is problematic and scientifically unfounded, said Dr. Dane Wicker, a clinical health psychologist at Duke who provides therapy for LGBTQ adolescents and students. Decades of scientific research do not support the political narrative that young people become LGBTQ because of outside influence. Wicker said, while volumes of research demonstrate that trying to prevent LGBTQ people from embracing their identities is harmful, quote, "There are no interventions or practices that can stop youth from having LGBTQ identities. In reality, these types of bills, the impact they're going to have is on concealment, people hiding really important parts of their identity and depriving them of the support they need to navigate these really critical pieces that affect their health and trajectory in life." Dr. Dina Adkins, pediatric endocrinologist at Duke, has spent years working with hundreds of transgender patients. The debate around gender-affirming care has unfortunately strayed far from the realities of how doctors like her actually work with families and young transgender people, she said this week. Quote, "Gender-affirming care is life-saving care with decades of research behind it. You wouldn't ask me not to practice a standard of care for any other care I give. You wouldn't ask me to not do what the American Diabetes says I should do for my patients with diabetes." And she said, "Current discussions don't reflect the reality of the care, nor the risks of suddenly making it out of reach." Quote, "This is a group of individuals, a small proportion of the population, only about 3% of those under 18, and they are quite vulnerable population. It would limit their access to potentially life-saving treatments that we have excellent evidence within the medical literature that this helps these patients in many ways. It decreases their suicidality. It improves their overall mental health. It decreases self-harm as well." For Sage, a 13-year-old non-binary person from Greensboro, gender-affirming care of the type Adkins described has been life-saving, as has been the support of their family, because Sage and their family have experienced harassment and threats during the transition. Policy Watch has agreed to identify them by their first name. After consultation with doctors, Sage and their family chose to use puberty blockers for about 2 years to delay its onset. The extra time allowed Sage to more consciously work through their gender identity and the steps they wanted to take to prevent gender dysphoria, which is a distress that comes from a misalignment of one's body and gender identity. Sage and their family said, "I had a lot of questions, of course," said Sage's mother. "This is a new territory for a lot of people, us included at that time. We talked a lot with the doctors about what could be done, possible side effects, steps for the future. Ultimately, we weighed this treatment against the dangers of our child not wanting to live in their body, and we made the decision that would make them healthy and happy, and they are." Legislation could soon prevent other young transgender people from having the same experience. That's something Sage, still on their journey of transition, thinks about a lot. They've stopped puberty blockers and are weighing next steps, such as hormone therapy or, eventually, surgery. But having these options taken off the table by people outside of the circle of their family and doctors feels wrong. Sage said, it's really scary to me that the things that have been available to me might not be, and that that could happen in a matter of weeks. Adkins says she is hearing that concern from patients and their families daily. Without access to safe gender-affirming care, there's also danger some will turn to black market medications and treatments, which aren't safe and tested, out of desperation. That's not something their family will do, said Sage's mother, but they will take their child out of state for treatment, if needed, or even consider moving if it becomes necessary. Sage said, this isn't something the government should be involved in. When a person and their family and their doctor make the decisions that are best for them. Having freedom in this country, including freedom of religion, also means having freedom from having someone else's religion used against you. Sage's mother said she's proud her child felt supported enough to speak openly with her and her husband about their gender identity and proud their family has navigated this journey with love. That's not the story every LGBTQ person has, she said. Some face physical violence or abandonment by their families. Others face so-called conversion therapy, a scientifically debunked and harmful practice North Carolina has yet to ban. We need to be doing everything we can to make this easier for our kids, not harder, said Sage's mother. For every kid who isn't lucky enough to have the full support of their family, who doesn't have access to the care they should, we shouldn't be making this harder. Well, I was not able to read even more articles, and you can find them and more on IndieWeek.com. So I'm John Fetterson, and saying for this week, this concludes Indie Week. The issue is available at ncreadingservice.org, as are many of our past issues, lots and lots and lots of them. So thanks very much again for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and we'll be back with you next week with Indie Week.